culture is sometimes not rich enough to give an individual an opportunity for expression. Indeed, and this possesses enormous questions concerning the representation of individuals in anthropology. But culture usually provides different modes of expression, though there is a general tendency to separate these modes from each other as if they represent separate parts of the individual body. And within culture, though the term is more an invention of the anthropologist than it is a fixed human condition, such modes of expression are understood as more or less individually significant. Here, cultural tradition as well as language becomes crucial in terms of riches. The form of language can be considered to simultaneously shape and limit individual perception as well as individual expression. The matter, of course, remains the question whether this shaping and limiting really concerns the form of language. In your essay on psychological reality of phonemes, you have frequently referred to the physical properties of language, describing them as... These physical properties are indeed, of course, to give us a signal, as if it were, for the identification of the given entity as a functionally significant point in a complex system of relatedness. But for any given context, it is notorious how many of these physical properties are, or may be, overlooked as irrelevant, how one particular property, possessing for the moment, or by social understanding, an unusual sign value, may have a determinateness in the definition of the entity that is out of all proportion to its physical weight. Here you have come across something crucial in our social understanding of language and the physical aspects of grammar. For sure, the emphasis on a particularly physical property must remind us of the abnormality of speech, for instance, in Nootka, which reveals the abnormality of body images with concern to the normality of speech. Abnormal types of speech among the Indian Nootka expresses person implication and classification through the tone of voice and types of addressing. Some of these types of addressing are meant as insults, but most of them are meant as a phonetic confirmation of the addressee's physical person. The only reason such types of speech appear in our research is because they concern abnormality. But I have no reason not to believe that this phenomenon is in fact part and parcel of the constitution of a grammar structure or pattern. You reach a similar conclusion, linking it to history and proposing these physical properties to suggest a psychological structure which was never there in the first place, except as a system of what I would call forgotten bodies, namely... Finally, the possibility of a direct psychological relation between consonant changes and the type of individual or attitude it symbolizes should not be ruled out of court. That such an association, once established by historical causes, will be felt as a direct and simple psychological association is quite obvious. Also, that it may become productive by analogy of further associations of the related sort. This makes the work you have done in the area very special, though the individual has been your topic all along and the body has not. Abnormal speech in Nootka shows that what can be felt as a phonemic structure is in fact a phonetic variation in physical typology. It is therefore nothing but social classification. If grammar disguises anything, it might well be social repulsion and bold discrimination. It's not surprising, then, that the opposite of such disguise will be revealed through the makings of music and poetry. Let's see if the bodily presence of individuals can be retrieved to such primarily emotional expressions instead of the secondary psychological establishments. Let's for a change look at what expresses lack of richness and how this is brought about by a general view of the sensorium of individuals in their struggle between traditional culture or maybe linguistic grammar and, on the other hand, bold expression. For in spite of the fact that you have stated that perhaps it is precisely the passionate temperament cutting into itself with the cold steel of intellect that is at best adopted to the heuristic value of rhyme, which you said in a letter to Ruth Benedict, such a statement might not necessarily point towards the Freudian assumption of sublimation, as another scientist, Landar, at one time proposed on a conference held in your honor in Ottawa, 1984. But for such an approach, we have to return to the expression as expression. We will have to return to poetry itself. I'm sure you find it interesting, though it might not compute with what you sense of cultural harmony. I will try to limit myself to one general question, which is, to what extent can the individuals bodily express themselves in spite of cultural tradition, and what is the cultural significance of their inventions? In other words, how do poets, for instance, deal with cultural miscarriages? And in which way can these miscarriages be seen as application of power through the phenomena of language? I have often wondered if not the heuristic value of rhyme and the so cold steel of intellect could not be separated by another outlook on poetry, one of language and rhythm, music, that is. It might explain what motivated you one time when you wrote to Ruth Benedict. There is one interesting facet of verse appreciation that we never discussed, but I am driven to it now. I refer to the relation of verse to music. I believe you were on the point of revealing something about poetry there, which you did not follow through because you evaluated your own language capacity as faulty in the sense of feelings, believing. I strongly suspect that my trouble is that my richest type of expression is a musical one, that my linguistic expression gets its color from rhythms and the intellectual content of words, but that the subtler feeling value of words and phrases is deficient for me. But the irony here is that culture, in the genuine sense of the word, the culture you once enlightened as creative, should have allowed for such an approach. It's merely a belief that poetry consists of idealized speech rhythms, which hinders us in the exploration of speech as a musical rhythm, as you found to be closer to your own poetry. And when you conclude, "This I do, that my rhythmical intentions are often, significantly often, missed, as though I were using words to carry pulses that are intrinsically alien to. And so often I have observed that when I read aloud what I have written, the hearer receives the poem as an entirely different thing from what had heard in his own silence." You're absolutely correct. But such a phenomena is not due to faulty poetry. It is rather the result of the cold steel of intellect which has given way to the warm expression of your own individual voice. The hearer might filter your voice rhythms through a separate intellectual category, or more so, you yourself might filter your voice rhythm, adjusting yourself to the cold steel of intellect as soon as you speak it aloud. There might be something in this space of individual silence in which poetry is perceived at its best. I would really have liked to know Ruth Benedict's reply, though unfortunately her letters to you have disappeared from the archives. But I will anyway attempt to react to the question you posed to her, which is, have you ever thought of this underground incompatibility of music and rhythm language? Or is it so absurd to theorize there being as many rhythmical accents in poetry as there are significant individuals with rhythm in their souls, be this rhythm of musical origin or speech origin or both at once? Let us assume for now that this underground incompatibility between music and rhythmic language is a fact which could be explored as the difference between the voice and the melody. What if the melody of poetry becomes a political act, not because it is political by definition, but simply because any shared public expression has such a capacity? You have hinted towards such an approach in your essay on representative music. Now, it might surprise you that a lot has happened since then in the practice of anthropology. Today, reluctant experiments are being done by anthropologists and linguists in the field of poetry as a form, though mostly as an additional form, of expression. Among others, Regina Dell, she wrote a biography of your work and life, has experimented with Cree education and poetry. She wrote an article called Ethnographic Genre and Poetic Voice. In it, she describes how the difference in teaching methods between whites and Cree Indians require a different set of expressive behavior, which is more in line with poetry than it is with the anthropological, intellectual account. For example, in Cree civilization, indeed, the teacher speaks non-literally because he cannot predict how his words will articulate to the later life experience of the listener or listeners. Life experience is more highly valued than frivolous words, according to Darnell. A fellow anthropologist, Bill Leap, made a study of Ute teaching methods, and he had to conclude that the children of the Ute have a hard time adjusting to the white educational system on account of the fact that they do not learn by memorizing facts in a generalized way. Contrary to generalization, Ute historical tradition consists of narrative which become individually shaped each time it is conveyed. One can wonder indeed if not the poetic voice is at best suited for the ethnographic account of communicating individuals with their perspective, individual perception of culture, or, as Darnell puts it, that anthropologists should acknowledge the validity of some colleagues exploring the possibility of poetry as an ethnographic genre, and the poetic voice of individuals in culture as a crucial source of insight into the workings of culture as a whole. There's a bit of irony here. One could never be sure whether a poetry as genre would not lead to the destruction of a phenomena as poetry, the loss of its authentic voice. And even though the general idea of poetry as the authentic voice is a Western construction, largely pleaded by Heidegger and others, poetry as an authentic voice has also become the voice of reversal. It has set in motion a black rap culture in the United States, in which music and words blend in the conveyance of the message of protest. Blues, jazz, and rap culture, wherever it is misconceived as a genre, would also be misconceived in the sense that you have explained to be your misconception of linguistic expression. Then Rose, another anthropologist, explained in his article, Reversal, that poetry should neither be viewed as a means for anthropological or ethnographic representation. It would be somewhat odd if an anthropologist would write poetry pretending to be a black man or an Indian, and pretend these others would not be able to write poetry themselves. There's also another, more penetrating reason against this view, at least I feel so, which is that the ethnography never is a representation. Steven Tyler once pointed out to us that there basically is no difference between the physical perception of a gathering data in the field and writing the ethnography, as the ethnography is the bodily perception of the field. Basically, the illusion of representation stems from the idea that the field body and the ethnographic body are of two different makings. The one is present in the field and the other is absent from writing. And here there is an ancient prejudice in which it is believed that poetry's voice coincides with a direct physical expression, while scientific and intellectual writing coincide with a sort of disembodied representation. Jacques Derrida, a French philosopher who has came a little after your time, extended this disembodiment towards every form of written language, proclaiming the text to be authorless. His views are very fashionable nowadays. They also constitute simultaneously an ultimate fiction of Western philosophy. Not only the presence of the author is denied its place within the text, the presence of the physical perception and its expression of reverse is also denied its place within the text. The creation and making of folk culture is exactly appealing to anthropologists because folk culture seems authorless. Derrida example of the authorless text did already exist for a very long time as the convenient phenomena of anthropological authorless folk culture and especially its musical expression, folk songs. Such an anthropological convenience is dangerous as the authorless text quite easily becomes the authorless culture, the culture ad hoc as truth. Its lack of authorship, the reader never realized it, of course, suggests at least shared value, not last a shared body, but remains in fact the illusion of a shared consensus. There is, of course, more to rhythmic poetry than the sense of individual variability alone. The musical origin and the speech origin at once involve a bodily experience. The one does not go without the other. Such a physical perception might or might not be partially cultured. Its individual expression has been contested in Western culture alone, and more specifically by the Hegelian interpretation of the world, which makes every individual body blend into the structure of synthesis. These Hegelian interpreters have been fiercely contested by the lovers of poetry, such as Benedetto Cross. He, for instance, writes, "So too, I could not accept their demands that the categories of forms of spiritual activity should be deduced or developed one from the other in an orderly progression by demonstrating their logical self-contradictions. Such a wearisome ballet of bloodless categories, finding a final rest in one supreme ultimate category, is precisely that of panlogism, or pure rationalism, which weakened Hegel's fatality and the effectiveness and against which I rebelled." Other interpretations, by for instance Derrida, reveal that the entire idea of the telos, the centered idea of uniqueness, is a Western construction, which is centered through the idea of structure. By governing the structure, it simultaneously escapes its structurality. Very little or no attention, however, has been given to poetry as a physical expression, which, by the mere fact of its physicality and its personal voice, could only represent a genre, provided that this genre would be constructed after the fact of creation. Also a rather Western quarrel between tradition, destruction, politics, and resentment. To return to poetry as a matter of reversal, then Rose, for instance, points out, The reversal, the space of discourse and the counter-discourse is a political space in which voices are raised that remains incommensurable. They do not map to one another. They do not share the same historical moment. Indeed, they do not. This implies that basically we do not actually need to be bothered with the idea of poetry as representation, as it, metonymically speaking, cannot be anything but personal voice of individual expression. Whatever the heuristic value of rhyme or the cold steel of intellect, there cannot be anything else but the telos that escapes structuration.